Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the funkadelics? What's happening? Mark Maron, this is my podcast. Welcome to it. Today on the show, James Corden of the Late Late Show. And then before that, I don't know what. That's not true. I did a little research. He's done some other things. But that was one of those situations. It's interesting. As a comedian, there's a few jobs that comedians can do in show business. You can do stand-up, you can write, you can act in a TV show, you can host. So James Corden comes out of nowhere, seemingly, to host a major talk show. And a lot of us were like, who the fuck is this guy? Where the fuck did this guy come from? Now, it's not like I was up for the job, but you start to think in terms of jobs available to your peers. And it, back in the day, it might have been, who am I going to be jealous of for getting that job? But now it's just sort of thinking in terms of comics in general. And this guy seemingly came out of nowhere. And a lot of us were like, what? Where? Who? Why? And I talked to him about that. He had a little of that going on himself, as it turns out. It really was a pretty great conversation. I enjoyed talking to him. And, you know, that's what you learn. I didn't know anything about him, and we had a blast. We had a nice chat, interesting guy, interesting background, comes from the part of the world that I'm not that familiar with and always enjoy hearing about. That's why I need to talk to people. It's got nothing to do with this show. I don't know if you people realize that. I need to talk to people so I am engaged in the human process and I'm not falling, let's say tumbling and bouncing down a tunnel of self. Got to stay out of that one, man. Especially if you've tapped that mine. You know what I'm saying? That's all I'm saying. I need to talk. It's not about the show. It's about engaging with other people. And I think that some of these talks that I do here help others do that. And I'm happy. I never knew that what has happened is helping in that way. I'm not checking in much with current events. I'm detached from it. And I guess it's because I don't manage my time properly or because I just honestly don't give a shit. I'd rather have the tactile experience of running my thumb across my fingers in a moment of immediate dark reflection of the temporality of my body and my being. What's Trump up to? Nope, I'm going to run my hands along my arm and realize that, wow, I am an animal and I am a physical being and I have to appreciate that and build from there and realize that my experience here on Earth is temporary but can be enlightening to myself and others. And I could also learn how to give and accept love and move through the world with some grace and purpose. That Trump's an asshole, right? Fucking A, man. What? This is it's a goddamn circus, this election so far. I want to feel my feet on the pavement. Perhaps I'll walk down my driveway with no shoes on and be very aware of the tactile experience of the new cement under my feet and realize I'm a human being on the planet Earth with very little time, and I have to make the best of that time. Wow. Wow, man. We're in trouble, man. This shit is crazy. The Kardashians? That's what? Maybe I'll lay down. I'll lay down on the dirt and just wait. Maybe I'll do that. Hey, one thing you might have noticed, folks, about the clip set of Lorne Michaels that we've been playing in preparation for the dropping of the Lorne episode is that pretty much everyone who talks about Lorne has a Lorne Michaels impression. So, as we approach the Lorne Michaels episode of WTF, here is a supercut of many famous people doing their Lorne impressions. All right? So enjoy this, and I'll talk to you on the other side of it.
You could have 8 SNL folks in a row, and they would all do a bad impression of him.
Do you talk to him now?
Yeah.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. We're friends.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like, he'll call and like, hello.
He's like, hello, hello. He's like, are you watching Jersey Shore? Loving this season. I think that Snooki's really made a change.
I realize, I've got the gig.
Yeah.
So, but I'm so shocked that I don't react with any excitement.
Yeah.
And then we stand up and I go, well, gosh, thank you. I'm going to shake your hand. Because I didn't know. He's like, do whatever you have to do.
Lorne says from his throne on high, the moment at the end of that sketch, that's the moment you became a star. I wasn't on the air for the next 4 weeks.
Like, I'm like, if there's a lady and a dude, like, what are we making fun of local news? What the fuck is that? He's like, no. He's like, he had some crazy thing. He goes like, you'll be Fred Astaire and she'll be Ginger. You'll, like, you know, give her the sex, a comedy, and she'll give you the sex. And I was like, the dancers? What? And I didn't know what he was fucking talking about.
The guy would be a monster news anchor.
Oh, my God.
I really feel that way, Lorne. And he's like, no, that's pretty much the feedback I get from everyone.
And so then I call, hello. I was like, hi, Lorne, how you doing? So we want to move you into the cast. Great. When? Monday. So, you know, just, you know, when it comes time to write, just write something you think you can score on.
And we walked in and he started telling me this and he went, so you're moving to California? And I said, yes. And he went, like, he just kind of like, he just, that's what he did. He went,
oh.
And I was like, yeah, you know, it's just been great working here, and then, but I think it's just, you know, and he was like, no, you know, I get it, and you have kids, and, you know, and you have to, you know, but, you know, they have backyards in Westchester, too.
So we got the sketch, he goes, Wayne's World. Lorne looks around, he goes, do we really want to read it? And I went in my hand, I went, hell yeah! Like this, as a joke.
Yeah.
And then he looked up at me, and sort of like, be ready? You know, this table will kill you.
It's fascinating to watch when someone's like, I'm not going to do that sketch. Uh-huh. He's like, no, I know, you're not. And when you do it, it will be fine. And the person's like, no, I know, but I'm not going to do it. And he's like, you're not doing it, nor should you. But I think when you find yourself doing it, you're going to, and this end up doing it. It's amazing. He's incredibly persuasive.
That was entertaining. Yes. Yes, it was. And folks, I promise you, you will hear the real Lorne Michaels on WTF talking to me very soon. All the stuff I've been talking about for 6 years is finally coming to a head, my friends. Yes. What will happen after that? Who knows? I will try to move my vessel of blood, muscle, and bone through time with grace and purpose. I got an email from a trainer in my neighborhood, and I'm going to take the chance. I'm going to make the leap of faith, and I'm going to go train, and I'm going to make my vessel perfect. Or I'm just going to feel better. This perfection thing's overrated. I was perfect for like 30 seconds yesterday, and didn't enjoy it. Did not enjoy it. The music you're about to hear, folks, is by Kelly Pratt, who also makes music under the name Bright Moments. He sent this to us, and we thought it was pretty cool. So enjoy this. All right, right now we are going to talk to an actor who is now the host of the Late Late Show. It's on weeknights at 12:30 a.m. on CBS. I was on it with Jason Segel and Carl Reiner. I will be on it again at some point, I imagine. But this is me and James Corden. It's weird because, like, in the States, I don't know how it feels for a guy who grew up in Britain that, I mean, like, it seems when you're in Britain, like, you know, once you get out of the cities, you're like, wow, it's really fucking beautiful. And
yes.
And here everything's different. And expectations, I really wonder what people's experiences versus their expectations. Like, how much have you traveled here?
A bit.
Yeah.
I've lived in New York at two points in my life. Sort of one for 6 months, one for sort of 7.5 months, and that was great. And then living here, and then the only other place I've really been is like Florida. You know what I mean? Going to like Disney World
with the kids.
So no, when I was a kid. So
oh, really?
I haven't been back for a very long time. But yeah, when I was like sort of 16, 17.
It's funny because even when I think of like just generalizing like Florida as a place, it's sort of like there's 100 cities, there's 100 different types of place there.
Well, that's the thing. So I've been to Orlando. I haven't been anywhere else.
Oh, you've got to really experience Florida.
Oh, I've really seen, I really feel like I know it as a place.
Go up north to the southern. As you go north in Florida, it actually comes more southern.
Yes.
In disposition.
But the weirdest thing about when you arrive, I can remember so vividly the first time I came to LA. I came here.
How old were you?
What would I have been? Like 27?
For show business?
Well, what happened was I had gone through quite a bad breakup with a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And my agent had said, oh, they want to put you on tape for this thing. And I was so sort of lost.
Do you remember what it was?
At home. It was, I do. It was the Jay Roach film with Zach Galifianakis and Paul Rudd that was based on the French movie.
Was it the Institution movie?
No.
I don't remember.
No, it was based, really famous, based on a French film. Dinner for Schmucks.
Oh, right. Okay.
There it is.
Okay.
So,
I wouldn't go see that movie just based on the billboards.
Sure. I didn't go and see it, but I did audition
title.
For it. Yeah,
right.
But at the time, when it's
big
like
deal.
Paul Rudd, sure. Steve Carell, Jay Roach, who I love, so... And I read it, and anyway, I was like, I'm not going to get this. This is a part that's written for Zach Galifianakis, clearly.
Oh, it was that part?
Oh, 100%. And I was like, this is like he should 100% play this role. No, they want to see everyone. They're really like that.
They brought you in to pressure Zach.
I don't know that that's true, but I went and auditioned. I said to Jay Roach at the time, I was like, so you're just seeing people in case Zach Galifianakis can't do this right? And he was like, no, absolutely not. About... 2 years after that, he came to see me in a play in New York and had forgotten that we'd met.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, you don't remember, I came in and auditioned for you and you told me, and I said to you, you're seeing people in case Zach Galifianakis can't do this. And he went, yeah, that's what was happening. Yeah. But he had forgotten all about it. But anyway, I came to LA.
You're shattered.
I was not in the best state of mind, and I came to LA, and I remember thinking, saying to people, "Oh, so where's the middle?
Where's the
middle bit?
Where the center?
Where's the central thing?" And when you realize there isn't one, and when you realize essentially Los Angeles isn't really a city, it's a collection of disparate towns, then you just go, "Oh, okay. Well, I'm just going to find the town
where
family will be happiest in." And so now I feel I've done that. I'm very much enjoying it. I'm enjoying living.
But you're a beach guy, so you decided on the beach.
Well, I don't know if I am a beach guy, but my wife would like us to be a beach family. Uh-huh. I don't think I'm a beach guy. Like,
Do you not get a lot of beach in Britain?
Well, you don't get a lot of sun in Britain.
Yeah,
so.
I know. But there's water. You're surrounded by water a bit, right?
Yeah, but there's no sun, so it's just cold.
It's a sad beach.
It's a coldness you never experience here. Like the other day when it rained here, I am fascinated by the whole place.
Oh, people freak out. Might as well be snow.
It's amazing how much people are like sliding. Their cars are sliding. People are like they don't understand what to do with their wipers on the car. There's like the news.
Yeah.
Just becomes all about rain.
Sure.
Oh my God, it's raining. Stay in.
Wash away.
Evacuate your house. Yeah. It's like, what are we doing? Here, if we had the rain that you had here at home, I promise you, my dad would be like, we should have a barbecue. This weather is
perfect.
This
perfect.
Weather is terrific.
Nice to cook outside.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Where'd you grow up in Britain, though?
I grew up in a very small town called High Wycombe, which is in between. If you head out of London towards Oxford, it's about an hour outside of London.
Yeah,
in a valley.
Yeah, so it's pretty.
It's surrounded by prettiness. The actual town of High Wycombe is quite a. It's painfully ordinary.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and I, you know, there's a, it is the,
like you could drive through it and not notice anything.
The high street is the same as any other high street in any other town in
right.
Britain. It's yeah.
How'd you end up there?
Well, my dad was in the Royal Air Force, so was a musician and was based in a place called Uxbridge, which is sort of close to London. And he was very adamant that he didn't want us to grow up on the Air Force base. He
right.
didn't think that that was a particularly.
So he was a lifer?
He was in it. Well, he was a musician for 26 years.
In the Air Force. What does a musician in the Air Force do?
Well, they play at all the big ceremonies and things like that.
So even, then, like, even of all sizes, like even if it's a smaller ceremony, he's on contract in a way.
Yeah, yeah, you're in the band. But then he went to the first Gulf War. He went to the first Gulf War.
What does he play?
Saxophone.
Brought his sax?
Yeah, no, they went as stretcher bearers.
The musicians did.
Yeah, they went as stretcher bearers and they didn't, you know, nothing really happened, but they were there. It was incredibly traumatic for us, but my dad was like, they were essentially just sat around not really doing anything.
So that was when the coalition was formed and Britain stepped in. They sent some musicians down to
yes.
carry stretchers
yes.
and the war was sort of a bust in a way.
Well, the war didn't really, I mean, nothing, like it was so strange because I can remember my dad saying.
It's horrible.
Saying,
they bombed the shit out of the place, but there was not a ground war really.
There wasn't, well, where my dad was stationed, he was in Bahrain and nothing really happened. And he said he can remember that someone got appendicitis. And all of these medics just rushed into this, you know, go, go, go. You know, like, he's like, he's got appendicitis. He's yeah. going to be okay.
But there was a panic in the family, huh? Because he was like.
Oh, well, it was horrible for us. He was away like 6 months. I remember it so vividly.
And how old were you?
Like 11.
So in your mind, it was just he's gone to war.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it's so strange if I think back to that time where it was just inconceivable. Like my dad said, when he signed up to the Air Force.
Yeah.
It was inconceivable to him that there would even be another war.
Ever.
That war would ever be something that would ever, that we would do ever again.
That was optimistic.
Well, that's the thing. And then you think about it now and you just think, well, I don't know when there won't be, you know.
Well, they've changed the business model of war.
It's so strange. Like, you're not really fighting countries anymore. You're fighting, you know.
Ideologies.
Groups. Yeah. It's very, very
You just throw
strange.
A coalition together and. You know, that's how the business operates now. Let's put a small coalition together of a bunch of people from different armies and go deal with this problem.
Yeah, I can't really get my head around it. If I think about it too long, I really can't.
Was he, what kind of sax player was he? Was he good?
Jazz. He's a big jazz sax player. So
was he good?
Yeah, really good.
Is he still around?
Oh, yeah. He's played on, when he came over, when we launched the show, he played with the band a couple of nights.
Oh, yeah?
And he absolutely loved it. I've never really seen him as happy, because now he's a Christian book salesman.
What?
He sells the Bible and Christian CDs and things like
door
that.
Door to door or what?
No, to Christian bookshops around
Britain.
That's
very specific.
Very, very specific. And, you know.
How did he get into that racket?
Well, he is a, well, him and my mother are both Christians, and we grew up in the Salvation Army, and then.
What does that mean?
The Salvation Army.
I know what the Salvation Army is, but here it's sort of where you drop your clothes off that you don't want anymore.
Well, this is the common misconception that the Salvation Army is a charity, and actually it's a church first and a charity second. So,
was it started in Britain?
Yes, a man called William Booth started the Salvation Army in Britain.
What was the angle? So it's an actual church.
The angle was that this guy, William Booth, saw that basically that churches were becoming elitist places that weren't. That weren't welcoming the poor or the marginalised or people around towns, and so he started a new movement where they would wear a uniform and they would march through the town, and he would say, "All are welcome here, and all should come here and be and are welcome in this church." And they would go and feed
and
the
had
homeless.
A church?
They had a church, and he said, this will also be a charity where people will go and feed the homeless, bring your clothes, we will clothe people, we'll do things like that. And that's where, yeah.
So it was actually, right, it was a well-intentioned sort of honest Christianity. Buy the book for all people, take care of the poor.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. And then oddly, that's kind of why my parents left recently. They left when I was about 18, 19. They left the Salvation Army because they didn't feel that was what it was anymore. Felt like it had become, again, quite an elite. Like, my mother's a social worker, my sister's a social worker, my dad's a Christian book salesman, so they have a very much a...
they're helping people.
They want to, they left the Salvation Army and joined a church, which was actually meets in a school at the end of our road, because they feel like churches shouldn't be... They feel like churches should be places that help people, I think.
That's interesting. My sense of the Salvation Army is that they, you know, they're ringing bells on the street.
Yeah.
At Christmas, sometimes there's a Santa involved.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're used...
Christmas caroling, I would go and do that every Saturday. Saturday morning, I would go and play the trumpet in a little town near us called Marlow, and we would stand on a roundabout in between a junction.
Yeah.
And just play Christmas carols.
Was your introduction into show business?
Well, the Salvation Army was my introduction into show business. It didn't feel like much. It didn't feel like it was show business in the middle of a turning circle, just, you know, playing Silent Night on a trumpet.
How many kids were usually involved in that?
Would be like about seven or eight of us.
It's sort of sad. It was a sad.
Oh, it was tragic. And you you'd take a cup of tea with you, and you'd put your mouthpiece in the tea because it was so cold. You were worried that. I mean, I just don't even. If looking back now, it was actually torture.
You were doing God's work, man.
Well, were we? I don't know.
So, that's interesting because I don't know that. Of course, I didn't know that about the Salvation Army, but they've always been. There's something about practical Christianity that's sort of impressive, as opposed to, you know, just sort of like passive Christianity. You belong to a church; it's a community thing, it's a social thing. But they seem like their hearts are in the right place.
Well, it's a weird thing. My dad always says whenever I sort of talk to him about various different things, he just says you have to remember that churches are groups of people, and wherever there are groups of people, there are going to be huge mistakes. And he just says, sometimes I'll say to him, you know, what if this is all just not true in any way?
Right? Religion, sure,
just not true.
Now, is this a conversation you had last week?
We've had it a few times, and I go, what if this is just not, like, you die,
yeah,
and you get wherever you're going, and it just wasn't the case.
Yeah.
None of this. Everything
or nothing happened.
Everything you've believed in,
yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
I go, how are you going to feel?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, do you know what? He goes, I've had a great life.
Uh-huh.
He goes, I'm proud of all three of my children. I'm proud of the relationship I've got with your mother. I've traveled. I've done good, and I've lived the life I'm proud of. And I've lived the life I've wanted to live. And then he goes, but what if I'm right and you get there? He goes, spend a bit of time thinking about that.
He just turns it around.
For a split second, you do go,
ah.
Oh, yeah.
but that's like sort of perfect in terms of, I think that having a righteous life and being able to own that and take responsibility for it and be satisfied, it's such a tricky thing. It's a very difficult thing.
Well, also, I think the biggest trick is, you know, like that there are many people who will talk about being Christians and talk about church and faith and when you just scratch past the surface, there is very little of their life which is remotely Christian in any way. If anything, they're just joining a club. Whereas, you know, like whenever people say to me about my parents, oh, your dad's a Christian, but you say the Christians, I go, no, yeah, but they're good Christians.
Yeah.
Like, they're really nice.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They're like, they're really cool with whatever you want to do.
Right.
There's no sense of, I'm very proud of them for that there's not any form of judgment or you know, wanting to impress any of their sorts of
But also, it seems that one way or the other, your entire family, I mean, I'm not outside of you. Perhaps you've framed your particular trajectory as service, but it seems...
Well, no, is the answer, but yes.
But it seems like they've led, they lead lives of service.
I think so.
I mean,
yes,
social workers.
Yeah, very definitely. My mom, you know, being a social worker, my younger sister being a social worker.
That's an insane job, dude. It's relentless.
Crazy, and it's thankless, and it's painful. And I didn't realize growing up quite how... quite what my mum's life was when she was going to work and then coming home. And then just, you know, me just moaning about what we're having for dinner or whatever.
And she's just spent the day dealing with drug addicts and domestic abusers.
Yeah,
and
taking children into care and separating children from sisters from brothers in families where they're worried that the father may be this. That, you know, it's just a different...
When did you gain the appreciation? When did it sort of dawn on you that, like, oh, my God?
Well, I remember when one thing I do remember is our school, we have this thing. I don't know if this happens at school here. A thing called the Harvest Festival.
No, that does not happen here.
It's ridiculous, right?
What is it? Maybe something like it happens.
It's a Harvest Festival where basically... You have to bring in like tins of soup and tuna fish or something.
Oh, yeah, we get that.
And you come in. Whatever. And the Harvest Festival this year, and we were doing what we were going to do in honor of the Harvest Festival. We're going to walk around our little village in the school in costume. And so different people said, oh, you guys are going to be cows and you guys are going to be sheep. And I was put in a group, like six of us, as. Squirrels, right? Uh-huh. You guys are going to be
another show business story.
Yes, well, and I'm about sort of 7, 8 at this time. Squirrels.
Yeah.
So I do that thing that you do at school. And I just came home and went, "Hey, Mum, in 2 weeks' time, Harvest Festival, we're doing this thing, and I need to be a squirrel." Okay. And Mum's like, "Yeah, okay, got it."
She's got to make the costume.
I presume that my saying that means that my mum knows exactly what to do and build a squirrel costume.
Yeah.
So Sunday night before the Monday, I come home and go, "Hey, Mum, what's the deal on this squirrel costume?" And her eyes looked in a way that just said, "Oh my goodness, I have no idea." I'm suddenly ringing bells.
Right.
So there's nothing.
No squirrel.
No
costume.
Shops are open. It's 8 p.m. on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So I went to school in a brown jumper, uh-huh. a brown sweater, a pair of my sister's brown leggings.
Like tights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My regular sneakers. And then my mum stuffed cotton wool and two pairs of rolled up jeans into a pair of her tights and safety pinned it on my ass. That was it. That was my squirrel costume. So I just basically looked like I had a huge turd just hanging off me while I'm wearing a pair of skin tight leggings.
Yeah.
I get to school and there's some kids have got like wire bushy tails that are up above. They've got like paws, makeup, everything. I had nothing, zero, nothing. To the point, it was that tragic that even the bullies were like, "Oh, his mum has really done him over there. His mum has just..." So I remember, we walk around the town, it all splits open. So I'm, as he walks back, I've got a torn pair of tights hanging off my ass. I'm holding two pairs of jeans under my arms and there's just balls of cotton wool. All just following me on the floor. And I saw my mum, who had come home from work and was stood on the road. And she looked so sad. And I can remember, I got really upset when I got back to school. And I remember the teacher saying, "You will realise one day what your mum has done today. And you'll realise the work that she does. And this won't be a thing." She was wrong. It very much is. It scarred me for life. But, you know, it does play on your mind.
Yeah, it's interesting when you have these... you don't quite see your parents as people for a long, sometimes forever, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly my having children has made me realize, you know, you'll just go, oh my goodness, you really.
It's a chore.
Yeah. Like, wow.
You've got two?
I have two children. My son is 4 and my daughter's 11 months, yeah.
Oh, you got a baby, so you're not even sleeping, really.
We are now. She's sleeping through, but we moved to America when she was 5 weeks old. So,
oh, my God. She's, yeah, like fresh out of the oven there.
Yeah, 100%. And just tough, like, you know, and then just trying to launch the show and things like that. But it was, yeah.
Let's go back there. Mm. So your parents, I mean, I have to assume that on some level that your father was a musician. He had dreams.
Well, I think my dad's dreams mainly were to get out of the house that he was growing up in, mostly. He joined the Air Force. Yeah, it wasn't good at all, and joined the Air Force when he was 16.
Was he from a big city?
No, he was from Stoke-on-Trent in the Midlands.
Yeah.
So, yeah, right in the middle of Britain is where he's from, yeah.
Everything sounds like Hobbit.
Well, it is. Well, he was even from, I'm saying Stoke-on-Trent, he was actually from, and you'll like this one, Uxeter. Which does sound like it's somewhere.
It sounds terrific.
Yeah, down in Middle Earth.
Maybe evil. Maybe there's a battle of good and evil going on there.
Mr. Frodo, we got to go through Uxeter. Come on, let's do it.
You weren't in any of those movies, were you?
I wasn't. I did audition for Sam Ganges. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I love four auditions.
How did you come upon performing?
Because
you weren't a great squirrel, and that wasn't
just
your fault.
Just a terrible squirrel. I just don't remember a time. I honestly don't remember a time where it wasn't what I wanted to do. I cannot remember. I didn't want to be a soccer player. I didn't want to be...
You love soccer, though.
I do, but, I mean, luckily, that was never something that I wanted to do. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do... There was just nothing else. I just wanted to perform and show off, really.
What was your original sort of idea? Like, did you sing?
I just wanted to do it. I wanted to do it all. I loved singing. I loved dancing. I loved acting. I love sort of showmanship, if you like.
What was the first time you did it?
Well, I remember I used to do impressions.
Who'd you do?
Well, people like Michael Barrymore and Cilla Black, who you wouldn't know.
But it doesn't mean I don't have a lot of fans in England.
Yes, or like Bruce Forsyth. Good game.
Yeah.
Nice to see you. And the audience would go, nice. And so I would do
that.
See,
I don't know who that is, but no. I enjoyed that impression a lot.
And I would do a lot of that. And
at school?
At school, at the Salvation Army on a Sunday, I would do little bits.
But would you do in front of people? You'd be like, now here's my son. Your mom would, and you do it in front of the audience at Salvation Army? Or?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, I honestly can't put my finger on like when or a time. I just cannot remember a time when I didn't want to do this. And I can remember we would have this careers lady come into our school, where she would talk about careers and what you're going to do and things. And I would say, I'm going to be an actor. And she'd say, well, no, you'd like to be an actor, but you've got to have something to fall back on. And I'd say, well, no, because if you're just contemplating any form of
just
failure,
a hobby. Yeah.
Like this is what I'm going to do.
That's interesting. I don't think I've ever thought about it like that. Because like I always sort of, I know that you're compelled, and you get it in your head, and that's what you're going to do. And some people, for whatever reason, have the fortitude to throw their life away and do that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. But I never really, I always thought, like, if you have a plan B, you're just a hobbyist or you're, but to frame it sort of like, well, that's actually setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah. Well, I also think it depends on what you think, what you consider to be making it.
Yeah.
Like, for me, like, just the doing it is the reward.
That's true?
It. Just, yeah. Like, whether it's, like, I feel like if you say you want to be an actor.
Yeah.
And you want to be an actor and you can eat.
Yeah.
And you can live.
Yeah.
Then that's it. Like, you've done it.
You're
like,
earning an honest dollar in a way.
Well, if, yeah.
Making
just,
a living.
Just if you can get by and act.
Yeah.
Like, then it's, you're just one of the lucky ones.
Right.
You just don't have to, because it's, if it's something that you truly love doing, then you're never really in a position where you're just, I don't know, working as an insurance salesman with a sure. dream of being an actor, you know, because you think, well, and that's the thing, I think.
But that's funny because, like, sometimes, you know, given what I've gone through, I mean, obviously our careers are much different, but, it, you know, when I hear people that say that, like, oh, I always wanted to do that, there's part of me that thinks, like, you're probably lucky you didn't, you know, embark. You know, like, there, it's not that I envy their stability, but there's something about living with the yearning or the heartbreak of not pursuing a dream, but having an okay life, that as you get all along in this business and you see how heartbreaking it can be for some people, where you're like, you might have made the right choice. Yeah,
absolutely. But because also you know you do have to be talented, and that's the truth. You do have to have an ability to do it. So if you've got an ability to do it, like I just always believe that and maybe stupidly and foolishly that true talent, raw talent, absolute talent will always get a shot.
I'd like to believe that too.
It works out or not, whether the stars align after that moment, who knows? But like, actual raw talent will always get a chance.
Right, if it doesn't destroy itself before it gets its opportunity.
Well, there is that, yeah.
And also, like, you know, I think that that at some point as a talented person, you have to realize, you know, what your talents are. I think that helps. That, you know, like, I know what I can do, and I know what I might not be able, I know what I'm right for. And what I can handle.
Well, that's the truth. I mean, because, yeah, and that can be quite a hard thing at times.
To learn.
To go, oh, okay, of course, I'd love to be Daniel Day-Lewis. But I don't know if I've got the necessary intensity to really fully commit 13 hours a day to being President Lincoln. But at the same time, I don't know that he would be able to do this over here. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, sure. You just got to go.
I like that the second half of it is like, yeah, he couldn't do it.
He couldn't
host a talk show.
He couldn't do a sketch with, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
although
yeah.
I'd love to see him. How much would you love to see Daniel Day-Lewis in a comedy?
It'd be great.
Because I just think he'd be amazing.
Did you grow up looking up to that guy? Like, who were your guys?
Well, of course.
Like,
the big one for me was a guy, I don't know if you'd have heard of, but he is just, for my money, one of the greatest comedy actors I can remember seeing is a man called Ronnie Barker, who was in a sketch duo called The Two Ronnies. He then did, he had a hit rate, which is phenomenal. He was in The Two Ronnies, which was at the time the biggest sketch show on television. And then he did he also had a sitcom called Porridge, which was written by Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet, which was just, I mean, gobsmackingly brilliant sitcom.
Ronnie Barker is his name?
Ronnie Barker. And then he was also in another sitcom called Open All Hours, where he and was like astonishing. And then he just quit and ran an antique shop.
I have respect for that.
He just went, I'm done, actually. I'm actually done. He opened an antique. He was interested in antiques, and he opened an antique shop, and that was it. And then,
did you go to the antique shop?
No, because he died quite a while ago. But he almost got coaxed out of retirement by Trevor Nunn to play Falstaff in Henry V at the National, which, if I think about it, might be the most dream casting I could ever imagine. But him I looked up to. I was really a huge fan of his. Rowan Atkinson, Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
I saw Jim Carrey the other day in a Whole Foods, and I don't remember the last time that I just like lost my shit.
Yeah.
Like, I genuinely couldn't. He was walking towards me, and I just froze. In a way that clearly Jim Carrey is used to seeing people freeze. And he went, hey, man. And I went, I just think you're amazing. And then he walked off and he was in the queue and I was going to my wife. She was like, you okay? I was like, it's Jim Carrey. And she was like, all right, but hold it together. He's right. He's literally 8 feet away from you. And I was going, and I actually went to her, I don't care. That's Jim Carrey. And pointed in his face. And he looked at me like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But
did he know you?
Well, there was an air of, oh, I've seen your face before. I don't think he would have ever thought, oh, there's James Corden.
Right.
I don't think he thought that, but I think he greeted me in a way that was as if to say, oh, I recognize your face from a thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, but like, yeah, he was.
Was that disappointing? Like, I do a.
No, it wasn't at all. I never expect anyone to have seen a second of our show.
But that's sort of weird, because the difference between you and me in that situation would be like, oh, I would be like, hey, do you have any interest in, you know, maybe talking? I do a thing. You didn't.
Well,
think-
yeah, I think if I had a podcast like you do now, then because this is such an informal atmosphere, this is such a nice thing to do.
Right.
I don't know that, you know, that this is such a joyously unpressurized environment.
Right.
And actually, saying to someone, do you want to come on the Late Late Show on CBS?
Yeah.
Is a very, very different question.
That's true.
Whereas actually you saying, oh, I have a podcast, which is hugely popular.
Right.
The President of the United States came on it, and I'd love to talk to you.
Yeah.
There's an air of, oh, wow, you would like to talk to me. That's amazing. Yeah. And I don't know that happens on a talk show that's on, you know, four
Okay,
nights
so
a week.
Which Whole Foods?
It was Brentwood. Brentwood Whole Foods. Don't go back. I've been every night wearing a Late Late Show with James Corden t-shirt. I haven't seen him.
Have you tried to get him on?
I just...
Were you bookers? Just say,
of course. But I'm not going to go, oh, can you try and book Jim Carrey? I saw him in Whole Foods last night.
Why not?
Well, I'd write to him first. I mean, that's what we've done with, like, the sort of, you know, the bigger people that we've had on the
You
show.
Write to him personally?
Well, we like, you know, to get, like, Stevie Wonder and stuff like that, we just, you know, you just, that sort of mission started back in, like June 5th.
So the bookers start reaching out.
Well, yeah, or we reached out and we knew someone who knew someone and just things like that, you know.
But so you book your show much the way I book mine. That's hilarious.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, so no, because then there's other, we have an amazing booking department, but like sometimes when you're going after like Stevie Wonder.
But I use bookers, but I mean, have you ever had that situation where they say, could you write a personal letter? I think it would make a difference if you reach out personally.
And it's still a no. That's the worst one. Yeah. Honestly,
the gracious letter.
This would make a real difference.
Yeah.
It's gonna be a no on that. Maybe next time.
Oh, it's not what it used to be. Show business. So, what did you go to acting school?
I didn't. No, I was at. I left school. At 16, and I started. I went to college for a year to do a performing arts BTEC thing.
What's that?
And
then, BTEC. What is that?
It's like a national diploma. So the idea is you would do that,
mm-hmm.
then go to apply for drama school, go to drama school, get an agent. But I had signed up with like a local. I used to go to an after school stage school in High Wycombe, where they had a real great time. I mean, it's an amazing stage school now, and is a much bigger thing than when I was there, but. There was a little period where there was myself, and then a few years below me was Eddie Redmayne, and then a few years below him was Aaron Johnson, the actor Aaron Ted Johnson. So we were, and like some, you know, like Eddie and I would be in like these sort of end of year things where I would sing like "Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat," and then Eddie would sing like "We're Walking in the Air" from The Snowman and stuff. And so I was in this BTEC National Diploma, and I got. I got offered a part in a musical in the West End that I auditioned for called Martin Gare, that was written by the guys who wrote Les Miserables and Miss Saigon. And
how'd they find you?
Be in the course. I was with this stage school and they had an agency. So I spent pretty much my whole school life between the age of like 12 and 16 just auditioning for anything that I could audition for, and I didn't get one job.
So they had an agency that worked with the company.
So it was part of the stage school,
And now when you saw Eddie Redmayne as a kid, were you like, that guy's good?
Well, he was great. The greatest thing I could say about Eddie is he feels he feels like the same person that he was then. Like, he is...
He looks like he's probably the same age.
but he's unbelievably warm and generous and...
Did you see that movie?
Of course, yeah. I mean, he's astonishing, and I think his new movie is going to be amazing too. The Danish Girl. He just looks incredible in it. He's unbelievable.
He's more. Is he more along the lines of who we were just talking about?
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, kind of, right?
Well, I think there is a yes.
Yeah.
Without question, there is an element of... my theory on acting is I think that there are two types of actors in the world, and that's it. There are only two actors in the world, and there are aliens and there are humans.
Yeah.
And neither are better.
Right.
Genuinely.
Sure.
Neither are better. There is no better
right.
in this. We just watch them in different ways. So your aliens are... Daniel Day-Lewis, Mark Rylance,
Meryl Streep,
Ralph Fiennes, where you look and you go, I don't know how they're doing that.
Meryl Streep,
this is
right?
amazing. Yes.
Yeah.
You go, well, she might be one of the few who cross over,
oh,
but...
Okay. Yeah. No, I know what you're saying.
But you go, you look at them on a pedestal and go, this is astonishing to me. I don't know how they're doing that.
Yeah.
And then there are actors who, whoever they're playing and whatever they're doing, are representing us, the audience.
Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman
sure.
is a great example of someone who is astonishing and amazing and yet finds a humanity.
Right.
Which you always is representing.
Can't hide it.
Yeah, you. And so you can watch like Mark Rylance or Benedict Cumberbatch playing Hamlet, and then you can watch one of my favorite actors in the world, an actor called Simon Russell Beale, with the same text. And one you're watching going, oh my goodness, this is, I don't know how this is happening. And the other one going, oh, well, that's me up there.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
You know?
And I like that.
And I think Eddie is an
alien.
Yeah.
And you are a human.
Yes.
Good. Yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's a beautiful way to look at it.
It's just what I've always thought. And I don't think there's any, better or worse. It's just the way that you know, Ralph Fiennes. What Ralph Fiennes, astonishing actor, unbelievable. But watch him in Made in Manhattan with Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem at home. You know?
Yeah. Well, he's not. It's interesting because a lot of those people are not, they're not leading men in the way that they're not thought of for a romantic comedy. They're not, you know, they need to do something larger than life.
Yes. Yeah,
and something that like you said, is unexplainable.
It's a transformation that you right. can't imagine you would ever be able to undertake.
Johnny Depp,
Fassbender.
I think.
Oh, Johnny Depp, same. Michael, you know, Fassbender, same
But Johnny
thing.
Depp's one of those interesting guys, and maybe Fassbender will turn out to be, but I don't think so, that Johnny Depp, like, it's rare that an alien becomes like a movie star personality.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like,
very rare.
Even somebody like Clooney,
yeah.
who is like one of the greatest movie stars we've ever had, is definitely a human.
Yes.
And not unlike, you know, even these people like Johnny Depp, who is arguably a great movie star, but he secretly is an alien.
Without question. Yeah. I don't even think secretly. I think just it's true. It's an alien thing, like, and his performance in Pirates of the Caribbean is as astonishing as any other performance you'll see, because you're like, with this text, this whole idea, you're making me believe in this guy. This is amazing, you know.
Did you see Black Mass?
I haven't seen it yet, but
just
it looks incredible.
Oh, it's heavy, dude.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's great in it.
Yeah, of course he is. I mean, he's... But you're right. But that thing with like George Clooney is a perfect example, where George Clooney, whether it's Michael Clayton or it's...
What a great movie that is. No one talks about that fucking movie.
It is amazing.
You know what saddens
film.
Me about, like, you know, about... There's movies like that are clearly sort of grown up, sophisticated, intelligent movies. And it really, like, no one talks about that movie, but it's a fucking great... It's a masterpiece, that movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, more people talk about that movie than talk about others. It's very odd. Some movies feel like they're just posters.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Do you know what I mean?
They are.
It's like, oh...
I won't go because of a poster.
Oh, that's a poster.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Won't go.
It's very strange. But, you know, Clooney's just just a phenomenal... presence,
yeah,
a charisma that is unquantifiable, actually.
And he loves it. I mean, I think that's the other thing about movie stars versus actors.
Yes.
Is that, you know, movie stars, you know, thrive.
They're good at it.
Yeah.
They're good at the whole thing.
Will Smith,
Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Tom Cruise is a lesson. They should show Tom Cruise on talk shows to actors in drama schools going, if you become famous,
yeah,
this is how you should be on a talk show.
Not on Oprah specifically, but maybe on other ones.
Yeah, but just look like you're happy to be there.
Right.
That's basically, if you look like you're thrilled to be there, yeah, you're halfway through. Yeah.
And do it to a degree that they don't even care if you're hiding things.
Yeah. You just come out and just, oh, this is fantastic. This is great. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, I've always said about Tom Cruise is that what he's really good at is focus and hanging off of things. That you give him something to focus on intensely or something to hang off of, it's great.
I love him, Tom Cruise. Oh, yeah. Genuinely.
I just watched Magnolia again.
Oh, that film. That film is genuinely, I think it might be my favorite movie.
I was sort of hard on it initially, but then I watched it again and I was like, wow, I didn't even remember seeing the last third of that movie.
Well,
it's amazing.
The bravery in that film, which is where I think like Paul Thomas Anderson is probably the best film director, I think, around in recent years,
yeah,
is that film's got two openings.
Mm-hmm.
The sheer bravery of that movie to then like I don't remember a time I've been as aware that I'm loving something the first time I'm watching it. I remember being in the cinema going, well, I'm loving this film. You know? Well, I'm in. I'm in. The music, dun, 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 the whole thing is this cannot be coincidence. This surely cannot be that. And then when they burst into song with that Amy Mann track and then the frogs falling from the sky, you're like,
what?
You've done it. Yeah. You've done it. You've got this film made in a world in which this is everything you'd ever want to do.
Yeah.
It's just astonishing.
Oh, it's beautiful to hear.
Oh, William H. Macy, Quiz Kid Donnie Smith. Yeah. Oh, I mean, come
Philip
on.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, Julianne
Moore.
Julianne Moore is unbelievable
in that
film. Jason Robards, it's crazy. Oh,
it's wall to wall, some of the best performances. John C. Reilly.
Great.
It's also well worth watching there's some outtakes on the DVD where John C. Reilly looks like he's the most fun person to work with on the planet.
Yeah, I bet you he is.
Yeah.
It's so funny because the first guy on IMDb is Pat Healy.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't know.
All right, so you do Martin Guerre.
Yes.
And then you do The History Boys, which was a big break.
Well, that was quite a while after that. I did a movie after that with a director called Shane Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with Shane's work. I did a film called 24/7. It's a black and white boxing movie with Bob Hoskins.
Oh, and fucking Hoskins.
Oh, man, incredible. And that film, I managed to get an agent in London. And then I had worked a bit, different TV things, little bits here and there. And then I was in this play called The History Boys, which was a real turning point.
My assistant's sort of like, he's in the original cast. Like, yeah, he's a real actor guy.
It was a real... I mean, as plays go,
yeah,
it was, I mean, incredible. And, you know, it's Alan Bennett, Nicholas Heitner, who I think is the best theatre director in the world. I really do. And, it was just a thing which, you know, you sign up for a play for 6 months and then 3 years later you're still doing it, but you've travelled, you've made a movie of it and you've travelled to Hong Kong, New Zealand, Australia, and then we finished by doing sort of 6.5 months on Broadway.
Do you think that solidified your sort of place that gave you the...
Well, oddly, it kind of didn't, because I'd done quite a bit of TV work and I did a film with Mike Lee called...
How was that?
Amazing.
Which movie was that?
I did a movie called All or Nothing with Mike Lee.
Like, his movies are just like... One of the great... sadnesses in my life is that I have not, and I can fix it, is that I haven't kept up with his movies.
Well, this one is particularly dark and I'm very, very proud of it. I play Timothy Spall and Leslie Manville's son, and it's basically the whole film is set across a weekend on one estate in London, and it's I think there are real moments of beauty in the film. It's Sally Hawkins is in the movie.
I'm just trying to figure out if I've seen
Daniel
it.
Mays.
What was it about?
It's set on a council estate in London. It's basically about the inhabitants of that council estate. It's hard to pinpoint.
What's a council estate?
A council estate is a house where basically the state is you put people up in these high rise blocks of flats.
Oh, okay.
In quite a rough area of London, and it's just about. It's about love and family, really, is what it's actually about. But it's a tough watch. But I had done that, and I'd done the film with Shane, and I'd done a couple of TV things. So when the History Boys happened,
yeah,
and became this unbelievable play, all of the boys, there was eight boys similar age in the film,
yeah,
all coming in with these film scripts under their arm for different roles they're being considered for or offered for,
yeah,
and I would get like the two pages of that script for like the guy who plays a news agent, or
so you were a punchline,
like, yeah, or like a bubbly judge,
yeah,
in something, and I'd be like, oh, I always thought that I would, oh, okay, and it felt like people at home were saying, oh no, we think you're very good. We think you're very good for this. You're really not going to be the star, are you? You know, and so that was when myself and my friend Ruth Jones, who is an unbelievable actress and writer at home, she hadn't written anything at home before this, and nor had I. And we just said, we should. Why don't we write a TV show together? So I had been at a wedding where I sort of came back thinking, I don't know that anyone had shown a wedding on television, like one I'd actually been to.
Yeah.
And we started talking about maybe writing a show about our couples and family, and we wrote this show called Gavin and Stacey, which, to everybody's surprise, it launched on a small cable channel called BBC Three, which not everyone in the UK has. And our first episode launched with like 500,000 viewers, and by the time we ended
That's big, right? That's
not nice. It's not big. It wasn't big then.
Right.
It wasn't small for
now
that
it's
channel.
Huge.
It wasn't small for that channel, but it was kind of fine.
Right.
And then we, when we ended the show, we did like 22 episodes over 3 years. We only do seasons of 6 or 7 episodes.
I love that about British television.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. And we, by the time we ended it, we ended it on BBC One, and I think we had like 14 million viewers tuned
wow.
in for
so
like the last
episode.
So
it was on the air for three years?
Yeah, and it sort of became, it pretty much became like the number one comedy in the country.
Well, that's amazing, because I don't know the show, because I don't, like, I'm not up to speed with British comedy, British television. Like, I'm sad that I don't know who Ronnie Barker is, but I didn't grow up with it.
Sure.
I mean, I know it's available, and I could have done a little more research, but I guess that's just not going to happen for me and you. That
no.
I'm not going to be like, that
well, it's
one
a long
episode.
Time ago. But people do, I do get occasional people like, Kristen Schaal was on the show the other day. And,
yeah.
And it was I'm thrillingly for me, he was a big fan of the series.
Well, there's definitely people in my community, in the comedy community, who are huge Anglophile, you know, like British comedy fans.
Yeah.
But I've always, it's sort of fascinating to me, the intimacy of what I picture the BBC's business model to be, and that the opportunity they seem to give comedic talent, because there's a lot of people I've talked to in here, like Dylan Moran, and you know, like Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright.
Yeah,
I've not talked to Ricky Gervais, but it seems that, you know, if you have a profound comedy talent and you have an idea, that you'll get a shot.
Well, Ricky and Stephen are the best example, I think, where they made a little short film. Stephen was on, I think Stephen Merchant was on a BBC Young Directors thing while he was also working at the radio station with Ricky and Carl Pilkington, and he made a little, I think like a 5 or 6 minute teaser with this character that Ricky used to do around the place called CD Boss. And then the BBC said, oh, will you make a pilot? We'd like to make a pilot. And what's amazing is Ricky and Stephen said, well, we'd like to direct it. And the BBC went, okay. Having no prior experience, and that's where, for me, the BBC are incredible. Like, we made our show with for the BBC through a company called Baby Cow, which is run by Steve Coogan
and
Henry Normal. And we would take all of our notes from the BBC or from Henry or from Steve would be, they would all start with, this is your show. No one knows this show better than you. So what we're giving you now are not notes, they're suggestions. And if you don't like them, throw them in the bin. And if you do, take them, but it's your show. And so immediately, as a creator of a show, you are so much more open to hearing a network's point of view on your show, as opposed to, we don't like this on page 3 and this has got to change on page 5 and we also think this character needs more of a thing, you're immediately on a defensive of like, whoa, hang on, stop trying to change my show.
Yeah.
What are you doing? So, and I kind of think that's a place where American networks, in a narrative sense, for narrative programming, could really learn from that, I think.
I don't know what the difference in the business model for how American television was sort of built, you know, on towards moving towards syndication or holding viewers in a certain way. A lot of that stuff has fallen away. So you get a lot of these people that you can't even trust.
Yeah.
So I imagine that having the BBC, who trusted Steve Coogan, I imagine, because he had that, what was his famous character?
Well, Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
Well, they even more than that, like to trust Ricky and Steven, two guys working at a radio station, to go, yes, we will let you direct, produce, and write this series.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Is unheard of, actually.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, that freedom creates what I think is one of the greatest sitcoms that's ever been made.
Yeah.
You know, I really do believe
that. And the British Office, what, there's only like 12 episodes, right?
Yeah, I think there's 12 and a Christmas, and right. sort of 90-minute sort of Christmas special.
I love that. Yeah. It's sort of like, I guess because, you know, you don't have this grail of 100 episodes making $1 billion that, you know, you can sort of, you know, limit your expectations, do as many as you think are necessary.
That's what I would often say to friends of mine. I remember telling, I forget who it was, saying what Ruth and I earned for Gavin and Stacey, and he nearly fell off his chair at how low it was. He was like, you're mad. What are you doing?
An American?
And I said, you're absolutely right. I said, however, what we lose financially comparatively,
right,
I always thought we were being paid very, very well.
That's the thing, but like when we started this conversation, I mean, it's nice to earn an honest living,
of course,
for doing what you do.
Yeah, but what really counts is A, you have this creative freedom which is unheralded. You're making the show that you want to make, and B, it's never going to be pulled off the air. You'll always get to tell your story. Now, granted, come the end of it, you might be telling that story to 4 people. But I can remember when we were writing Gavin and Stacey, and when I wrote the next show I wrote with my friend Matthew Baines in the show The Wrong Mans, all we would say is, how great would it be if this was just one person's favourite show? If sat around a dinner table somewhere, someone said, oh, you know the show I love? Gavin and Stacey. And everyone goes, oh, I haven't seen it. What is it? And they go, no, I love it. That's all we were ever really hoping for. You know, hoping for like awards and, you know, right.
Did you
like
win
that.
Awards?
We did, yeah.
So you did, like you did several, you did that sitcom, which was your own. You appeared on a lot of stuff. You've done all the things that one does as a television personality in Britain.
Mm.
And then you do this huge movie, Into the Woods, with Meryl Streep, who must have been amazing to work with.
Phenomenal, yeah.
How was it like being with an alien?
It's just incredible. Yeah. I mean, she is, I've never really worked with anybody quite like it, actually.
There's nobody like it.
Well, also, she, the greatest thing I can say about her, and it's my favourite thing in people, is when she takes her work unbelievably seriously. She is incredibly serious about the work that she does, and she doesn't take herself seriously at all.
Right.
And that, for me, makes for the perfect person to work with, because I don't like it when people don't take their work seriously, and the only thing I hate more than that is when people take themselves very seriously.
And if they're doing both of those,
oh, it's just the pits. When people think that they're, you know, changing the world,
and like, they're not putting the work in,
she is astonishing. Yeah, amazing. And
was
just
she
amazing?
Was she nice?
Oh my God, beyond nice, like nicer than nice. She's so aware of how you feel when she walks in the room that she just does everything she can to put you at ease in that situation. I love and adore her. Yeah.
So now I'll lay it out here in America.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as a comedian and as somebody who talks to people that,
yeah,
you know, when that spot opened up on the Late Late Show,
yeah,
and they were auditioning people that I knew, I never got the call, but that's fine. I'm not everybody's cup of tea. But then, you know, out of nowhere, we're all like, who?
Yes. Absolutely.
Who the fuck is James Corden? But it was sort of like, it was unprecedented in a way. You know, that process. How did that come about?
I don't even really know.
You don't?
Well,
You just got a call from your agent?
No, I'll tell you how I don't. I had come to America and
it's off course for you in a little bit.
I had done a play in New York called One Man, Two Governors. Uh-huh. And it was a really great play. A brilliant play, and I had some very nice reviews from it, and I won the Tony Award that year. And I didn't know this, but like Nina Tesla, the president of CBS, and Les Moonves, who's the CEO of CBS, had seen that play and were quite determined for me to do something on their network. I didn't know any of this at all. So I had an idea to make a TV show, and I was going to make this TV show. And
here?
Yeah, and I had an idea for a narrative comedy, basically about heartbreak and how relationships and things like that. And
so you had a pitch?
Yeah, I had like a few fragments of ideas, and I talked to people, and I was very, very wonderfully had a feeling. I decided that I was going to make the show for HBO, and I went and I saw Les Moonves and Nina Tesla, and we were talking about this, and then we started talking about Late Night.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some talks about Late Night, and I said, and I was just saying, I think that Stephen Colbert is the best appointment they could ever make. Mm-hmm. I said, I think it's amazing. And I said, I think the trick after that show is you've got to sit the other end of the seesaw. I think there is no point having two shows that are similar back to back, like
operating at the same intensity.
Nowhere else in television would you say, from 9 till 10, we're going to have a medical drama, and then 10 till 11, we're going to have another medical drama with the same diseases.
Yeah.
And they just sort of go, well, what would you do? And I was like, well, I think I would bring all the guests out together at the same time and try and make it feel a bit more conversational. I'd sort of try and do a bit more like sketch, silliness, songs, dances, just silly things. Like try and make people smile, because Stephen's going to take care of politics. He's going to take care of all of that. And we would just like to be a place, a warm place, that would make you smile before you fall asleep. And I wasn't really sort of pitching.
You weren't selling it.
I was just kind of talking about it in general. And then they said, would I like to do it? And I felt very, very reticent about it. I really wasn't.
Why?
Because I just hadn't considered it as something that I would want to do. And I didn't think it was something that I wanted to do. And I love acting so much. I really do. I love being part of a company. I was enjoying the different things I was getting to do. So I was going to write this show for HBO, and I was going to do a Broadway revival of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, the Stephen Sondheim musical, and I was going to do both of those things. And then the more I thought about it, the more it just became clear to me that there was no way I wouldn't regret this, and that I would much rather...
Taking the opportunity.
Yeah, that I would rather regret doing something than not doing something.
Sure.
Like, and if it doesn't work, if it's just awful, then I'll just go home, you know? And then I started thinking about it and thinking, well, actually, for my family right now, at this point in our lives, to be around them in the way, like, I'm actually made the decision in South Africa when I was Skyping my son on my birthday from a
hotel
prison. No, a prison in Johannesburg. We were filming in a prison in Johannesburg. And
for
I was
what?
Like, for a TV show I'd written called The Wrong Man for the BBC. And I was like, this is only going to get harder. Like, my wife was pregnant at the time. I was like, leaving them. And from what I can work out, no one really ends up on a therapist's chair going, my dad was just around too much.
Right.
He gave me too many cuddles at the weekend. And they were so unbelievably open and receptive to making the show whatever we'd like it to be. I thought, okay, yeah, I'll jump.
Yeah.
And we'll see, you know. And I still feel like we're sort of still jumping, really. I'm interested to see where it lands.
Did you feel... like that there was a sort of this guy's, who the fuck's he think he is?
I didn't actually. I don't
until you sat here.
No, I didn't. I didn't because I guess I never really saw it as that sort of slot. I didn't really see it. Right. I always thought, yes, of course. Like, if you were going into like the slot that Stephen's just taken on,
yeah,
then yeah, I think I would absolutely feel that. But I think I thought, oh, okay, well, I was very conscious of the fact that when we needed to hit the ground running,
right,
that we needed to have a really good first few weeks, like that there was no time to explore and, oh, we'll find out what the show is on the air. Like, I felt that very much.
Did you do that?
I think so. Yeah. I think our first, I'm immensely proud of our first episode. I feel like it gave us, I feel like if anyone was waiting to say those things,
yeah,
that I feel like in our first episode, the best we could hope for was,
putting a lot of energy in.
All right. Yeah, you know, like the bit we did with Tom Hanks, yeah. I feel is like a really strong, solid bit. We did a sketch that I thought was like a pre-taped film sketch.
Yeah. You got good writers. I know those guys.
And I was very conscious of wanting to find people who hadn't necessarily written in late night before, you know.
Young guys.
Yeah, young guys who would be hungry to make a young and vibrant show that,
well,
yeah.
Well, it's sort of interesting because you came in with that, you know, that tiredness, you know, that it's very funny because, you know, when you talk about the work early on, when you're on stage or doing that, there's something a little thankless about it at a daily show.
Yes.
Because there was a big realization I had when I used to appear on Conan a lot, the old show, and now I do this show a lot. But when I go do Conan, which was four times a year, three or four times a year, five times a year, like I'd get off and I'd be like, all right, where's the party? That feeling of sort of, I did it. And then you just realize just a bunch of fucking people at work.
It's just the same the next day.
It made me respect them more.
Well, that is the best and worst thing about it. Mm-hmm. Because the truth is, there is another show tomorrow. So if you do one where you've missed the mark slightly. Oh, I thought that idea was going to be there. I didn't really.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what happened. But you go, do you know what? It's gone. There's another one tomorrow.
Right, right.
Where it's hard is when you go, oh, that was a good show.
Yeah.
Like we had a show last night. Mel Brooks was on the show. I did a sketch with Mel Brooks. I did a stupid dance with River Dance. And we had a pre-taped bit, which was me and Joe Theismann throwing fast food at each other as a stunt driver from Fast and the Furious drove through a drive-thru.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, that felt like a good show.
Yeah.
And it's gone now. That's it. It's gone. Like, you're like, right, okay.
Yeah, next show.
Oh, okay, here we go. You know, and that's it. But there's something very gratifying about that. And you just, you know, you just got to get your head down and just keep going for it and just keep working. And
Is the group format working? Because I did the show and I had a nice time. And I noticed a couple of things that stood out for me, having done a lot of those kind of panel shows, is that one, there were not enough dressing rooms for me. And I was put into a weird someone's office.
No, that was not your fault. That was not our fault. That was because, I'll tell you why that was, that Wiz Khalifa and Fall Out Boy.
Yeah.
We're performing together
on another show.
We were pre-taping it for another show, but we didn't have a musical act on your show, and they were very much coming as a collective,
right?
And Wiz Khalifa did not think that, and just went into your room and went, "I'll go in here and shut the door and lay down," which is not ideal. That's the only time that's ever happened.
Well, I'm glad I had it.
That's the only time that's ever happened.
I'm glad I had a single experience in someone else's
office.
And
I promise the next time you come back, you will have
It was funny because I get there, there's this great dressing room, there's food out, there's a party going on, and they're like, no.
You're in Josie's office. Yeah, I know. I'm really sorry.
They walked me outside.
I'm truly sorry.
No, it's okay.
I really am. It was.
It's fine.
It was so far beyond our control.
Well,
Wiz is not someone you really just go into.
Yeah,
he just doesn't
out.
Have that. Yeah, he doesn't have that.
No, I understand. I'm just busting balls. But the thing that, because I'm sort of fascinated with the dynamic of creating a, not necessarily a panel, but like having more people out there at once without a topic specific show. You don't see that much in America. Like, you know, Politically Incorrect used to do a thing where they'd have four people out, but you know, you had things that everyone was commenting on the same thing.
Yeah.
And to generate a genuine conversation in that environment is tricky. And I noticed it was me, Jason Segel, and Carl Reiner. And I think that the wild card was that And I don't know, I'm just going to ask you, like, I've interviewed Carl before, and, you know, he's obviously amazing, and, you know, he's an elder spokesman, and, but that's also the thing that you realize once he's out there, it's like, you can't really interrupt.
Well, no, you can't, and that's, but then, you know, I just find great pleasure in that, and I just think, mostly, it's, well, you know,
does it work in general? Like, are you finding that the guests are playing off each other?
Yes, and, very much so. Like, very much. And I think guests enjoy. I think lots of guests enjoy the notion of not just a fixed 8 minutes on them. I think actually, oddly. Because you would imagine it would be different, but when you think about it, it makes complete sense. I think the people who feel least comfortable, I think, in that environment are comedians. Because you are... comedians, the very notion of being a stand-up comedian is...
Solitary.
I talk, you listen,
yeah.
I'm bringing some stories,
yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah.
And that is the format of lots of talk shows.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Lots of talk shows... Oh, you know, if you're a stand-up, I've got a great thing about supermarkets.
Sure.
So if you could ask me a question about going to the supermarket, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
And that is kind of difficult to juggle on our show because you never quite know where the conversation's going to undulate and move to. The only thing I think is, I think there are five other shows where the guests come out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Come out individually.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it just comes from a place of like, we have to give the show a reason to exist. It is not enough just because there has always been a late, late show after the late show that there should be.
Yeah.
We've got to give it a reason and we've got to make it feel and look different.
Yeah.
You know, Reggie, himself is just like a phenomenal presence in that environment. And,
I found it refreshing, and for me as a comic who's done the story format.
Yeah,
you know, when I heard it was going to be me and Jason, who I know.
Yeah,
and Carl, who I've interviewed.
Yeah,
you know, I wasn't upset at all, and sort of like, how am I going to get this in? I was sort of like, oh, this can be easy.
Well, that's it, and that's the truth of it. That's what most people find is actually, it's a joyous thing where you think, well, actually, if this was. If in fact we took these cameras away and this was a dinner table and we were all eating,
yeah.
This would be joyous.
Yeah.
This would be great. Like, we had a show with Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Elizabeth Banks, and I've just never had more fun. Just the three legs, and we were just chatting. I didn't get through half of the card.
So you lost your, that's great.
I didn't get through half the card.
So you didn't have to be self-conscious.
No, because you go, we talked about this project and then we're going to talk about this project later. So actually, when Lily Tomlin is talking about something and Elizabeth Banks asks a question and it's not mine, the joy of sitting back and watching that flow is wonderful. And some nights are harder than others, but then that's the case for all talk shows.
Yeah.
You know?
And how are you easing into the monologue and everything? How are you feeling about it?
I'm finding that, again, that's another sort of thing where we try to do something, you know, to not do 15 jokes,
interacting with an audience as James Corden.
I'm enjoying that. We have some really terrific writers who come together and we just tend to do the monologue about one topic.
Yeah, I like that.
Which is very easy some days and much harder other days.
Sure.
And that's the truth.
Well, because you're in. Like, if midway through the thing's not working, you're like, oh boy.
Well, what you can't do is go, in other news, Donald Trump said, the idea
can't
of doing...
Bail.
Yeah, but we, you know, I feel we've had some really good ones. We've had some ones that I'd like to do better. But we, you know, what I'm realizing is I'm finding it a lot easier to do them... those monologues and things when they are about something of any substance.
Sure.
And I think at the start we thought, oh, our show, we'll just do stories about Facebook.
Yeah.
You know? And actually what you realize is if it's about something, it doesn't have to be funny all the time.
Yeah.
If you're doing
connect.
It about Kim Davis and her coming out of jail and refusing to issue gay marriage certificates and the prospect of her going back into prison. That's a topic where you go, well, actually, regardless of the jokes, this is an interesting thing to talk about. And that's where I hope that our show over the next 6 months, we could find a little more substance and depth in that.
It's
the thing I've realized that I've enjoyed doing, which I think at first I thought the show would just be like atmosphere. But I think we can retain elements of that. But at the same time, I would very much love the show to find a greater sense of depth in the places where it's possible to.
That's great.
Yeah.
And
I
what's
hope
your
so.
What's your contract for?
5 years, I think.
Oh yeah, so you're in.
I mean, they can sack me. You
right.
know what I mean? They can sack me at any point,
right.
but I don't think I can leave. So
you better like it.
Yeah, there
better
is
make
that.
The best of it.
Yeah, well, and we're going to try to, and I really am finding more and more out about it every day. I mean, you know, it's tough, you know, to just come in just sight unseen.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, there's something very freeing about that.
Sure. So now, like, to wrap up, tell me about, like, I've had a couple of knights in here.
Mm.
And you're an officer of the Order of the British Empire.
Yes.
What does that mean?
I don't. Well, it means that you are given. It's below a knight. You're not
sure.
A sir.
Yeah. Are you a duke?
No, I don't even know if anyone's a duke anymore. I don't know. But
you're an OBE.
An OBE, yes, which isn't the
Who order. Who gives that to you?
Well, it's issued by the Queen.
But you don't get to hang out with her.
I didn't get mine from the Queen. I got mine from Princess Anne.
Mm-hmm.
And you, yeah.
Was it exciting?
It's really exciting for your parents.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
really. No. I'm saying, like, genuinely, your first thing is, I don't deserve this. I should say no to this. This is not something.
Really?
Yeah, you should say, there are so many. Particularly growing up in the household of two social workers, of thinking, well, this is something that you getting being given this for services to drama is not so. But however, then you go, well,
that's
actually,
funny because that's exactly what a social worker does.
Yes,
services.
Yeah, it's drama. You're absolutely right. Whereas actually, the truth is, you know, then you think, well, I you owe it to for my mum and dad. Going to Buckingham Palace, sitting there, name read out, giving this thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful, lovely thing. Yeah.
And they loved it? They're,
of course. It's great. We went for dinner. We went for lunch. We had champagne. It was just...
Oh, well, that's
It was lovely. And that is... Yeah. That's what
sweet.
That is. But I'm not entirely sure what I meant to do with it.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much. That means the world to me.
And congratulations on the show. Great
Cheers,
talking
man.
To you.
It's such a pleasure. I've loved every single second of it.
Yeah, I like that James Corden guy. I would have maybe lunch with him at some time. I would sit across from him again and chat about things. See what's going on with that. I can play guitar a little bit.